Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Charlie Harris is a South African singer and songwriter. He is known for his compelling storytelling and heartfelt performances. Charlie's music is deeply rooted in the folk rock tradition, yet it transcends genres, creating a sound that is both familiar and refreshingly unique. After years of writing literally hundreds of songs, Charlie realized that there would never be a perfect time to release an album. The decision to move forward with Digital Dust came from the realization that now was the time to bring his music into the world without waiting for the elusive right moment. Charlie released Digital Dust Side A and Digital Dust Side B in 2024, with plans for a third album to be released in 2025. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Charlie Harris.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
All right, where in the world? Thanks for having me on, first of all. In Johannesburg, South Africa, that's where I am.
So for the listeners, I see as a view in the screen behind me as I'm speaking to Charlie on Zoom, lots of guitars, lots of hats, lots of interesting things in his background. But Charlie, so now let's rewind. At what age, whether it was a child or teenager, did you feel cool? I want to be in the music or creation world. And how did that process or journey continue from where we are?
Okay, so it has been a long journey. My passion for music is, you know, it feels like it's been endless. So obviously, when I was a little boy, my uncles, they all played guitar and some drums and bass, and they all had their band. And I was a little boy, and I thought that I idolized these guys. I thought, this is great. And then they started showing me some guitar chords, etc., and I wanted to play music. It was a few years later, I was probably about 13, 14 years old, and I could do a few chords and stuff. And I had this one case where I was actually keeping my song sheet. So the case was called Santa 77. And it was just an old junk case I had as a little boy. And I thought it was great. And I decided, let me write a song about Santa 77. And that was actually the first song I ever wrote. After that, it was history. I just wanted to write songs. I loved writing songs. And I loved performing songs, you know, etc. But songwriting has been my passion forever. So my journey has been to be a songwriter. And now I would like to get some recognition, see if somebody likes it or do something with it instead of just being on my computer.
Has it been a process of when you were sort of deviated from that passion and got into the working world, and now that passion is reignited, that you're actually going out there and releasing and performing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So you know, obviously, once you leave school, your time starts becoming limited. Now you've got a career to build. You're studying. You focused on, you know, getting your work off the ground so that you keep this table, that you can do things, and music couldn't provide that, could provide the passion, all of that. So, you know, I prioritized that first. But over time came, your passion never dies. I absolutely love music. I absolutely love writing songs. And I didn't want it to die. So about 15 years ago, I mean, me and my buddy Sean, he actually does all the drumming work with me. We connected by chance as well. And we kind of gelled. And then we thought we were a metalheads. Then we were told we were punk. We didn't know that. And we were like, hey, how can we be punk? We want to be metal.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as time progressed, we were doing gigs around that. I used to write songs around that. But the passion has always just been songwriting. Not a style, not a genre. And we've ended up back to our roots, which we love. And I've just write songs all the time and performing them.
So there's this perception in society that we need to box things or stereotype things to make other people comfortable. So this means heavy metal, that means punk, this means you're in this category or that box. And I think it's fear related for the rest of the world to know, okay, I know what box you form under or you fill in. So it makes me comfortable and I know that I know what to expect, so, sort of thing. And it creates comfort zones. What are your thoughts around this interesting topic of societal labels and boxes and stereotypes?
Yes. So, first of all, for me, I don't give two hoots. about labels. It's nice to know if people want to categorize you or know. The example, if you do rock and roll or you're doing death metal, you do, yeah, it's there. But I take one song, and this has been out, and I got a lot of feedback. How do I write songs that can transcend a couple of genres? You know, if you like country, it could be country, it could be folkish, or it could be rock, the same. And I said, well, I don't write it to do that on purpose. I write it what feels good, what feels great. And then I have my style that is an uneducated style, but some people like the guitar work. They're saying, and I think I'm a real idiot at it. And I've had some seriously feedback from session musicians that say they can't recreate their sounds. And it's simple things for me and simple things for other people, I'm sure. But I write it, if it feels good, it feels good. Okay. And that is what I write most of. The vibe, the feel good. It could be a sad song, it can still thrive. So I wrote just for what feels good or feels nice. And the music for me dictates what the song's going to be about. And I decided not to be, not to purposely go for genre. Write the songs. When you've got over 100, you know, 150, 200 songs, there'll be a lot of songs that can be, you know, put in boxes. But in general, like the album, it is kind of open for a lot of interpretation. And I really liked it.
Okay, so you've referenced already that you write songs that make you feel good. So let's unpack that a little bit further. So your creative process, your creative brain, we already know what motivates it, but is it easy every time? Do you collaborate with other artists or other writers? How do you further unpack that creative process?
All right, so let me put one of the things is, and I refer to Sean, he's the drummer, he's not a vocalist, he's not a songwriter. But one of the things, when I'm writing, I'm always thinking of the song when we're doing live and how we will do it. So that is one thing, there is an element in that. But what happens is and I'll be sitting here, for example, and I'll be playing my little acoustic guitar, and I'll come up with a riff or something that sounds good. I'll just take my cell phone and record that little riff, so I've got it on record. So I've always got about 30, 40 of those riffs in the bank. Then I would play around with this riff, let it develop, let it feel it. Then based on the riff, how does this feel? How does it do? What the song is going to be about? And it starts developing a kind of like song, but it's not laid out yet. And then I start fishing out some words, some catch, and some hooks and stuff, and I see what they're about. And then eventually the song takes shape. And then I sit, actually now saying, right, there's going to be an intro, or it's not going to be intro. How are we going to build this up? Or is it start off big? What's the song feel is going to be? In other words, a sad song, you could have lost somebody, and I've recently done a song like that. But it's a feel good that you're just sitting having coffee, just thinking of that person, and it's making you feel good as a memory. So it's a sad song, but it's a feel good song.
Yeah.
And the music linked to that. And then you're going to, you know, be creative around that. And then it comes words. When you've written 200 songs or 150, but it might, is things is really coming up with words. Because you can be repetitive, using some phrases over, saying the same thing again. And I let the course take its course, but you've got to be aware of that. Otherwise, you could end up with 40 songs that's actually pretty similar and stuff. And you don't want to end up in that cycle of things.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do two or three songs, and I see which one's actually the right feel of good. And then I keep the other two in the bank again, can rewrite the words there.
Okay. So you reference this. So for the listeners who do not know, what's a riff?
All right. So a riff is, I took my guitar, and I like, do a D thing, and I pick in ding, 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 for example. I say, okay, that doesn't sound too bad, but then you start putting some emphasis on it, and then there you got like a little riff and a little hook or something that sounds quite good. It could just be strumming through four chords. I say, well, this sequence of the chords, the chord progression sounds good, and with a caper on, et cetera, and I've got that. So then I've got my core or idea of the song on that. And then I'll build up from there.
Okay, cool. You referenced the album. So tell us more about that, first of all, and what's coming up for short-term and long-term plans for moving forward.
All right. So the album's called Digital Dust, Side A. Digital Dust is, I saw not a podcast, but interview with a guy who was talking about the best song that never made it, okay? And he was saying a lot of artists are recording songs, a lot of songwriters record songs, and they just save it on a hard drive or a memory stick or somewhere. And those songs sit just gathering digital dust. And this song a big chord with me. So then we came to do the album. So I met up with Robin Welsh, and we were just by a mutual friend or acquaintance, and he asked me to sing some songs, and he was very interested in the songs. And I had to sit, and I sent him about just over 100 songs, and actually went through them all. Then we had to sift down these songs. We came down to about 19 songs, and he didn't want to reduce any more. Then he said, well, let's make two albums. I said, okay, well, we'll do Digital Dust Side A, Digital Dust Side B, because actually the blend is like a journey through both albums. Mm-hmm. And that's where we ended up with Digital Dust Side A. So that's the short-term goal. The long-term goal is next year, we'll still need to do a few more recordings. Maybe it's probably another album because that is on the cards. And we'll be doing that. And then we're going to be, you know, canvassing for a lot of bigger gigs and festivals to play at and building the band's repertoire that way.
I love me a CD. I love the journey of the energy exchange for you guys, because it's a thank you to all the hard work you do. The journey of the choice, the receiving, the unpacking, the booklet, the thank yous in the booklet, the images, the artwork. I'm not sure if you're aware, vinyl's massive comeback in the world. Somewhere in Asia, they just reopened a vinyl factory that had been closed for 50 years. Last year alone in the UK, 5.9 million vinyls sold, the biggest since 1990. Cassettes are on an upward resurgence, not as much as CDs and vinyls, but CDs also, again. So in the UK, there's a basket of products that they gauge for tax purposes, you know, the exchange of them. And vinyls have been in that basket for the longest time. And now because of the upsurge of CDs, that product is now back in the basket. And the research is showing it's not the older people who are nostalgic diving into it. The research is showing that it's actually the teenagers, the younger kids, the early 20s that are diving into the physical world. But we've also got the streaming platforms that people consume music on. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
All right. So on the CDs and stuff, yes, it has been a resurgent. So the only people that have ever asked me for a CD, which has been two, are people with old cars that have only got CD players still. So the rest, most of the people I've done, what's the YouTube channel still? And I'm talking like the media net kicks, okay? And then Spotify has also been one of the main things. They said, oh, are you on Spotify yet? I said, wait for the release. So that's the two main venues. Then of course, there is Instagram. And Instagram is not really putting whole songs. It's more advertising, putting part songs, more promotional work. We use a lot of that Instagram and TikTok. And then the one place a lot of people go to is our website. To look at. There's videos, links to the YouTube, links to Spotify, links to everything like that, links to the Facebook page. And it's got all our gig schedules on there, got photographs, videos, and all that type of thing. So even though it's a little bit old schoolish websites, it is still one of the most effective ones. And you can centralize a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So for you, it's for your observations in your world, it's more about the digital space, and that's
yes.
Okay, understood.
For now, that is.
Yes,
for now, that is.
Yes.
It could change.
No, I mean, absolutely. When you start getting the bigger gigs and performing at the big festivals and stuff, there's going to be merch tables.
They might want it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So let's see how it unfolds moving forward. Now, how is your relationship with social media? What do you feel around it?
All right, so social media for somebody like me has been a little bit of a blessing.
Okay.
Because before, especially if you're working, to go canvas for gigs, get videos, get your stuff out there would be manual. You'd literally have to go there. So now it's still a hefty gig. People want to see you live. And we enjoy gigging. So that will always be part and parcel. And our energy live compared to the album is very different. Or it's a lot more energy on the live set. Social media has given me a platform where I can daily, weekly, send out things and people can know what you're busy with. They can see a song you're busy with. They can see a video you've done. And it's there now. So that for me has been very, very helpful and in a lot of ways rewarding. Everybody must be aware. You always will be criticized as well. Part of the parcel, have a thick skin, and not all criticism is bad. I said. And the one thing I did learn that everybody can know, not everybody's going to like you 100%. My odds is if 10% of people like you, your odds is quite good. So obviously, you know, on a lot of social medias, we don't get that much criticism at all, which is, thank goodness. But you do get criticism wherever you go. Somebody's not going to like you, and that is it. I don't think you suck.
Yeah, I mean, that's life. No one's going to like everyone all the time.
The biggest artists get knocked. If you just go to any local venue, the biggest artists in the world get knocked. What makes you better than that?
I agree, but it's also I feel it's important for those people who are doing the knocking to be respectful and compassionate and have empathy, not to be vicious and vindictive and cruel. And unfortunately, there's a lot of that going around at the moment. So
there is a lot of that. I don't think it will stop, but it is a good thing if you yourself is in a good place. So when you're starting off, criticism is quite hard to handle. And you're ready because you haven't got or done anything, and now you think it's the worst thing ever. And you've got to get past that.
Yeah.
The way you get past that, friends, your band, and realizing if there's just three people that like you, focus on those. And that's what we do. Now, 10 people like us, like, that's our crowd.
Yeah. Well, like you said, like at the moment, at the beginning, it will start affecting you. But if it's affecting you, it means that's your ego playing. You're playing with your brain.
Yes.
And it's not your authentic self. So I'm reminding myself as I'm speaking at the same time. So thank you. So you mentioned that your live set is different to what sounded on the recording. It's a different energy. So why is that? And what do you enjoy about performing live?
So why is that? Is because, like I said, Sean and I, we go back quite a while. We've just got an energy on stage. We tease the hell out of each other. That humor comes onto stage. There's a bassist joining us, Andre, and he's fitting quite nicely. It actually was, we got on YouTube in the series of, so what we do is get a guest artist, and we just sit with a con and acoustic guitar. We do like a live song, and the guy must learn, whoever's our guest must learn that song, and we do it. And he fitted in. And we have such an energy about, hey, guys, because Sean sometimes just goes so fast on the drums. And we're like, wow, this is going to be the fastest we ever play this song. But the energy of teasing, giving each other grief, back and forth and stuff. And if I make a mistake, then I 100%, I'm going to blame them. And everybody will know it's me, including the crowd. And I'll just find some way to push it that way. And they're like, yes, Charlie, for sure, for sure. And that's the way we play. Like, you know, like I would start the show, like, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the drummer is one of the best drummers in the world. He's on time. He does that. But unfortunately, he couldn't make it. Sean came. So, like, I'm teasing my drummer and stuff. He's like, oh, yeah, they already know that, you know, and stuff like that. So it's that kind of banter that we have and we give. And that energy comes. We're excited about what we're going to do. And that energy definitely translates across and makes the gig or the show a lot more pleasant in that sense. And then, of course, we have a part of the show that we can really get to, but be a bit more sentimental, show a bit more another side of stuff, and then back to giving each other grief.
So, Charlie, I love this game. I know if I had to ask this question in 2 minutes, 10 years, 5 hours, I know your answer will be different every time, simply because there are millions of them. I understand that, and I recognize that. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists once you finish this conversation, what would those 5 songs be and by whom?
All right. So, lucky to know, On Heaven's Door, Bob Dylan, I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah. Sorry, which one? Which one? So say it again. Which one?
Lucky to know, Heaven's Door.
Okay. Okay, yes.
Bob Dylan. Nirvana. A few of his unplugged tracks I could go for any day. That was, for me, quite a big deal. Golden Earring Unplugged, The Naked Truth. Okay. I had a few songs on there that was quite good. And I was also, you know, I didn't know Neil Young and stuff like that, but Neil Young, Heart of Gold, is like a really cool song. And I think everybody knows it, made a classic. White as Shade of Pale, another classic song. And it's all kind of like oldish songs. It's like strange because I'm more into the Nirvana side of stuff.
But I mean, I know if I had to ask you this again in 5 minutes, you'd have a different group. So that's what I love about this game, because it's just like whatever comes through at the moment. So, Charlie, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
Well, I'd like to say, give me a listen. Give me a chance. If you like it, enjoy it. But I hope it brings you as much pleasure as it brings me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook @CelebSavant. That's CelebSavant.